And welcome back for those who were here last year, for those who were not here last year, just a welcome. I can welcome you back also, I suppose, if you like. For year two of two, we expect, on Ezra and Nehemiah, I do expect to send out a follow-up email either later today or tomorrow that will just remind people of where they can find the audio recordings online. In particular, for those who are new, you'll know where you can find recordings of last year's classes online. I expect also that after today I will have everyone's email addresses on the email list, and therefore I will be able to send you the sheets and notes in advance of each class. I generally try to do that by Sunday. I generally succeed by Monday. A reminder to please, if possible, and that was exactly what I was going to remind, please make sure to make your cell phones silent. Thanks. So I thought this, we have to start with a review. The truth of the matter is I no longer feel like I need the review. Having done the review, now I feel like I know it. So hopefully everybody else will be in the same place by the time we conclude it. But this really needs a review, even for people who did it last year. I think it's probably worthwhile. I hope that was a phone being offed, so to speak. Okay, good. All right, so in order to learn Ezra, you actually need to go back before Ezra. And we need to go back to the history, you know, before Ezra ever shows up on the scene. The sheets, by the way, are on the back table there for anyone who doesn't have one.
Classes?
Yes, indeed.
Okay.
Yes, indeed. And I'm going to send out later today, I expect, the... I'm sorry? Yes. It keeps me honest. So, we go back to the history that precedes the book of Ezra, which paints a picture for us that our exile, as well as our return to the land, are not a function of geopolitics, but rather are a function of divine will and divine orchestration. So, as we learned in the beginning last year, sin leads to destruction and leads to exile. King Chizkiyahu, going back to the first temple, the first Beis HaMikdash, was supposed to be our Messiah. He was supposed to be our Mashiach, the Anointed One, described in the 11th chapter of the book of Yeshaya, but he fails. In Malachim Bet, the book of Kings 2, we're not going to go through all of these verses now, this is what we saw last year, but I did give you references on the review sheet, so you can look it up if you like. But Chizkiyahu failed. When he showed the stores of the Beis HaMikdash of the temple to Babel, to Babylon, looking for foreign alliances, and God responds by saying that he's going to exile all the vessels and he's going to exile the descendants of King Chizkiyahu. And the Jews as a nation sin, leading to exile for their own guilt. Even though their sin is considered to be inspired by bad leaders, the nation is going to be exiled. They're guilty of idolatry. They're guilty of murder. And so they are sent into exile by, first, the Assyrians from the northern kingdom. That's its own discussion. And then the Babylonians, who exile the southern kingdom. Yirmiyahu, the prophet Jeremiah, predicts it will be 70 years in exile. And we are told from the beginning that God is then going to bring us back. And God even calls his shot in the 44th and 45th chapters of the book of Yeshaya. God makes a distinction between himself and idols. He says, idols and idolatry, they're not capable of telling you the future. They're not capable of telling you what is going to be. I can tell you the future. And here's a newsflash. My anointed one, Koresh, Cyrus, is going to lead you back to the land. Now, the biblical critics read that and say, well, that can't possibly have been called in advance. You can't tell me that before the Jews ever go into exile, before anyone has ever met a Persian, you're going to have a prediction about Cyrus, this eventual Persian king, bringing the Jews back to the land. It just can't be. On the other hand, anyone who believes in the concept of nevuah, prophecy of God speaking to a human being, is fine with the idea of God giving this level of detail. We even have elsewhere in Tanakh predictions made about future kings, most famously Yoshiyahu, who is also named long before he is born in a prophecy of Achya Hashiloni to Yeravam ben Nevat, which is a story in its own right, but that's in Malachim, in the Book of Kings. So too, God makes the prediction. Amos Chacham, I think, is the author of the Dat Mikra edition of Yeshaya of Isaiah, and he posits an in-between solution to the problem of how you can call a shot that far in advance and not totally ruin history by doing so. And he floats the idea based on various sources that Yeshaya actually had a school of students, and he gave them scrolls. He gave them texts of his prophecies, and they weren't necessarily meant to be disseminated, but they were meant to be studied privately among themselves. And that's the story of and that's the story with this prediction of Cyrus. So it was always an internal document until it became publicly relevant, and therefore nobody knew about it until it was relevant later. But to me, that takes the teeth out of it. In any case, from the beginning we are told that the Jews are going into exile because they have sinned, and that they are going to be brought back by Cyrus the Persian. And that's sort of background. That brings us to the books of Ezra and Nehemiah, which speak about that return under Cyrus. So first of all, one note that we made about these books is that these are not history books. They inform us about the events of the Jews. They inform us about regional events to a certain extent as well, but they're not history books. And what I mean by that is they don't spend a lot of time on history, and they miss a lot of detail because it's not really important to them. There are even entire Persian kings who don't appear, just because they're not relevant for us. They didn't do anything with us, and that's not really the focus of the books. These books are meant to record the milestones in our national return to the land of Israel and our construction of the Second Temple, the walls of Jerusalem, and so on. And to a certain extent, I think it's also an attempt to legitimize the Second Temple as an extension of the First. We saw already last year, we'll see more this year, about ways in which the books connect the settlement of the Jews in the land for the Second Temple with what they had in the First. The goal is to say, even though we're much poorer, even though we don't have the heroic kings that we're familiar with from the heights of the First Temple, nonetheless, we are their legitimate heirs, and the Second Temple is for real, so to speak. That's the goal, to my mind, of Ezra and Nehemiah. The Jews at this time are dealing with various Persian kings. Happily, I can tell you that our dealings with the Persian kings are almost done, in the sense that all of the confusion that we dealt with last year about how many Artaxastas and Daryavishes are there, like, you don't have to worry. They're done. Whatever we understood, we understood. Whatever we didn't understand is history, so to speak. But we saw four named Persian kings. There was Koresh, Cyrus, also known as Cyrus the Great, also known as Cyrus the Second. He is the one who allows the Jews to come back to the land. Then we saw Daryavash, Darius, who may be Darius the First. And then we had one line that mentioned Ahasuerus, the Ahasuerus who may be Xerxes. And then we have Artaxasta, who is Artaxerxes, and he is the only one we're really going to see for the duration. The others are already dealt with, and we spent a lot of time on it. When I send out the email later, and I send out the link so you can download all the past audios, you can go back to those audios, and you can let me know if they make any sense. among the Jewish leadership, we met Shesh Batzar and Zerubbabel. Those were the leaders of the Jews when they first returned, along with Yehoshua ben Yehozadak, who was the Kohen Gadol, and I don't want to spend a lot of time on them either, because again, this is something we did a lot on last year. We're not going to see it as much this year. What we do note, though, is that Ezra and Nehemiah appear not to be in that wave of Aliyah. In that first group, they are not mentioned. Ezra does not show up until chapter 7. Making Aliyah, it appears, decades after that original Aliyah. Although, we noted there are other ways that you could read the book and suggest that he was there but under a different name. And that may fit with something that we are going to have to deal with later this year, which is a section of Nehemiah that appears to be in the beginning of Ezra. And we have a phrase in Hebrew for those who are familiar, Daya Letzara B'Shaita. Right? It's enough to deal with the problem at its proper time. We don't need to create the headache until we officially get to it. But that's all just background for the book. A little bit about the identities and so on. Are we clear on that? I'm doing a lot of monologuing, and I apologize. Yeah. Yeah, because the focus of it isn't history. Meaning, it's not a book that's trying to inform the reader of the events of that time, such that the reader will get a comprehensive picture of what life was like, or even comprehensive would be wonderful, but even a basic image of what life was like. The book focuses consistently on events that we experience, told from our point of view. And doesn't spend time really discussing anything that doesn't have to do with Jews. You know, we find out, by the way, that we are part of the Fifth Empire, or Fifth whatever district, of the Persian Empire, only because a decree mentions that. But there's no background. I don't know where districts 1 through 4 were. Okay. You know, things like that. Oh, it's not right. My comment is not to reflect on the historical accuracy of the books, but rather to reflect on what their mission is. And the mission is not to give me the history of the era. That's what I mean. Yeah.
Can you please elaborate on legitimization of the second Beit HaMikdash? Was it not considered legitimate when it was built? What's going
on there? So you may recall, it's a good question, you may recall that when we learned about the initial dedication of the Mizbeach and then of the Beit HaMikdash, the temple, there were people who remembered what the first one looked like. It can't have been a very large group of people if you had 70 years in between, and especially now add the time that it took to build the first temple after the return. But there's a group that remembers it, and they're described here in Ezra, as well as in the parallel text in Haggai, as crying and feeling like this just doesn't match what we remember. The Gemara, further commenting on a verse in Haggai, says that the miracles of the first temple are not there. The miracles that we are familiar with for the temple don't exist. The Aron, the Ark with the tablets, is not there. The memorabilia of the desert, if you will, was gotten rid of before the first Beit HaMikdash, before the first temple was destroyed. So Chizkiah gets rid of the copper serpent that Moshe had made. He destroys it because they're starting to worship it. So things like that are gone. They're impoverished. The house of David is no longer the house of David. In any real sense of the word, even though Zerubbabel is a descendant of the Davidic line, but you're now many generations removed from David and Shlomo, and most of those intervening generations were not Asa, Yehoshaphat, Chizkiyahu. Most of them were problematic. So, not to mention, of course, we don't have autonomy. You know, I've been learning Malachim Aleph now with my daughter, and just going through that text of David and Shlomo and the building of the first Beit HaMikdash and contrasting it with this, it is so stark a difference. Meaning, Shlomo ascends to his height, and the best perek, the best chapter, is really Malachim Aleph perek, it's either Yud or Yud Aleph, where the queen of Sheba comes to see him because she's heard about his wisdom and she has all these questions and she interrogates him and she loves the answers that he's giving, and that leads her to bless the God of Israel who made this wise person his king, and everybody from afar is amazed, and they all come with their questions and they send gifts naturally. That's the heyday. And now, we are at best vassals of the Persians. right? We talked about how the Persians really brand the Beis Hamikdash, right? They brand the temple. Right, you have the Air Canada Center, soon to become the Scotia Bank Center, right? So you have the Persian, essentially, it's the Persian Beis Hamikdash. Right? We'll talk more about that in the review. I don't want to jump ahead too much. But that's why there's a need for legitimization. There's a need to say, even though this we don't have the autonomy, we don't have the miracles, we don't have the great leaders, we don't have the pedigree, we don't have the wealth, nonetheless, this is a temple of God. Despite everything, this is still a temple of God. And I think it's interesting, because I think that to us, it's hard to relate to the hesitation and doubt they would have. Meaning, imagine the following, because this has never happened in a Jewish community ever, the following. Imagine that there's a big synagogue, a major synagogue, grand and beautiful and glorious, with a big Aron Kodesh and many, many members and all that. And then there are people who don't feel at home there anymore. And they decide, we're going to make our own breakaway shul, and it's going to be in a house somewhere, and we have a Torah, and people will borrow and share their talises and whatever, and that's the way we're going to muddle through. So I don't know that we would have the same feeling of insufficiency in that breakaway like they felt in the second Beis Hamikdash. But it's that kind of a come down from where you've been. It's like, well, is God going to be interested in a house like this? Is this what God wants? That's the way they feel. I'm not sure it resonates with us. I'm not sure we hit that same block, but they certainly did.
Was it also a question of the legitimacy of actual building like we have now?
Right. So that would not have been a problem. Ari makes an important point. The one thing that they did have was prophecy. They had Haggai and Zechariah, and then in the next generation they had Malachi, and those are the ones who grant them any legitimacy at all. Without that, there would be the question of who gave you the right to build? How do you know you're building what you're supposed to build? How do you know you're in the right place? And I don't mean the right mountain, because that would have been known to them, but the placement of the altar, things like that, without the prophets, they would be stuck altogether. This is true. So, in the book itself, yes, Susan?
You said they say a prophecy, but I think you said something about the different kinds of prophecies. And I can't remember what you said about how they got their prophecy. They didn't get it like Moshe Rabbeinu. So I can't remember what you said, how they got their prophecy.
Right, no, so the prophecy is on their level. What I had commented on last year is that their prophecy tends to be opaque. Whereas Moshe's prophecy consists of God telling him, this is the message, go tell it to the Jews, right? Or go do this, in a direct instruction. The further along you go in Jewish history, the more the prophecy tends to be a vision, which the prophet is then expected to analyze and explain. So you find that in Yirmiyahu, right? The beginning of Yirmiyahu, you find that. Lesser extent in Yeshaya, more as you go further in Yechezkel, and then you get to Zechariah, and I mean, Zechariah is just weird visions, which he's interpreting, and then you get to Daniel, who just looks at the Malach and says, I don't know what this is, help me. And even Zechariah, the Malach says, what do you see? And he says, I don't know. It's much less clear to them, which, according to some, is because of their lower level. In other words, they are less able to perceive the divine will, and therefore it's coming to them in these images plucked from their brains that they're now supposed to interpret and understand.
But we assume they always interpreted it right?
Yeah, otherwise it doesn't make it into Tanakh. We don't get the outtakes. That's, we don't get the ones where they just said, yeah, I know what this is. Let's go to the next one. If there were such things, I don't know. Okay, what we do get is when the Malach says to them, do you know what this is? And they say, I don't know. And then the Malach explains it. So in chapter 1 of the book, for those who want to have the Ezra in front of them as we go through it, it's page 1814 in the Green Tanakh. Okay. So, chapter 1 begins with Cyrus sending us home. Based on historical evidence, as well as says the book of Yeshaya, it seems like Cyrus does not believe that what he's doing is a religious act. Even though his wording is religious, right? He labels God in the beginning of the book as Hashem Elokei HaShamayim, the God of the heavens. It sounds like he is doing this religiously in that sense. However, it's likely that Cyrus was just using that language because he knew that it would appeal to the Jews there, and it fit what he was trying to accomplish. You see, we have in our possession the Cyrus cylinder. And the Cyrus cylinder, found in the 20th century, I think it was within the 20th, not in the 19th, declares that Cyrus is restoring Babylon and supporting the temples of Marduk. Because Marduk, the Babylonian god, had rejected the Babylonian kings and chosen him. So Cyrus, the Persian who has conquered the Babylonians, presents himself to the Babylonians as the anointed one of their god, and the one who is going to restore their temples and restore the service of their god Marduk. Same thing is what's going on here. Cyrus comes to the Jews and says, I am going to restore your temple. I'm sending you back to build it. And it will be a temple for the God who resides in Jerusalem. And it's simply a smart strategy. Right? This is Conquest 3.0. Conquest 1.0 is beat them into submission and keep them there. Right? And that's historically the way that many empires did it. Conquest 2.0 is the Assyrian model. Right? Tired of dealing with populations who rebel, the Assyrians say, let's mix and match. We'll move the populations around. They won't have roots in the area. They won't feel as invested in the land that they're residing on. And therefore, it's going to be harder for them to rebel. The Persians say, why do you want to deal with rebellion at all? You're their friend. You're their redeemer. Are you kidding? This is wonderful. We are benevolent dictators. We make the rules. You pay us tribute, but you can worship as you choose. And in fact, your God likes us. That's the way they present it. And it inhibits rebellion. Why would I want to rebel? The Persians are doing a fine job. So that's their tack. And they do it with the Babylonians they conquered, and they do it with us. So likely that's what he thinks he's doing. He does not think he's doing the will of God. He thinks that he's doing the will of Cyrus. And I support my contention with a verse from Yeshaya, from Isaiah, which I'll actually, I'll have you take a look at it because I think it's worthwhile. It's page 1033. Yes, it is chapter 45. I'm looking for the citation. That's why it's taking me a second. Chapter 45, sentence 4. Actually, start with sentence 4. 45:4. This is where God identifies Koresh. He identifies Cyrus as his anointed one. If you were to look at chapter 45, sentence 1, God says to his anointed one, Koresh, L'mishicho l'Koresh, you see that? So if you take a look at sentence 4, it's Yeshaya, chapter 45, sentence 4, page 1033. God says, Leman avdi Yaakov v'Yisrael bechiri, for the sake of my servant Yaakov, for the sake of my chosen one Israel, v'ekra lecha b'shmecha, I have called you, Cyrus, by name, achanecha v'lo yedatani. I have named you, kinui is a name that you give somebody. I have given you a name, velo yidatani, but you don't know me. That's what God says. This is his message to Cyrus. And then he continues, Ani Hashem ve'enod, I am God, there is no other, in case you were confused about that point. If you got to the 45th chapter in Yeshaya, you don't know that. We go back to 1. Zulasi ein Elokim, there's no God other than me. A'azircha, I strengthen you, v'lo yedatani, you don't know me. So in other words, he's not knowledgeable of God, Cyrus. That's never the point. But God is going to use Cyrus for this purpose. So that when you go back to Ezra, you find in Ezra chapter 1, on page 1815, you find it says, Heir Hashem es Ruach Koresh Melech Paras. God aroused the spirit of Cyrus. God awakened Cyrus. It's God using Cyrus as a tool, as part of his plan. Clear? That's the idea. Note, by the way, of course, for those whose shul say Anim Zmiros, right? Achancha v'lo yedaticha, right? Which we say to God, Achancha v'lo yedaticha, we name you, but we don't know you, is actually God speaking about Cyrus. I named you, and you don't know me. That's consistent. Piyutim always draw on psukim, except when they draw on medrash. Yes.
Did Cyrus do that with other nations?
Yes, that was what I mentioned about the Cyrus cylinder. He did it with the Babylonians. He may have done it beyond that, but that's what we have the archaeological evidence for. And that was his tactic. Debbie and then Berea.
I didn't.
Oh, okay.
Cyrus knew that he was being basically used by.
No, I think Cyrus thinks that he's a smart politician.
He didn't know that this whole thing.
Yeah. Right, so there is a notion of Cyrus being aware of Yeshaya's prediction, but in the text itself, we have no indication of that. Correct. He's being smart. You know, this also, by the way, has its parallels in Yetzias Mitzrayim and leaving Egypt, right, where God manipulates the Pharaoh. So this is just, you know, this is God. This is what God does, right? He controls kings. So this is something that you just see repeatedly in our history. You see it with Nebuchadnezzar, right? Nebuchadnezzar, God calls Nebuchadnezzar my servant, even as he destroys the Beis HaMikdash, he destroys the temple. He's just, you know, moving the pieces around the chessboard. Okay. There were other parallels, by the way, to leaving Egypt in chapter 1, such as the idea of the neighbors giving gifts to the Jews who are going to come to the land. That brought us to chapter 2. Chapter 2 had the extensive name lists, right? 70 verses, but pretty much almost all of them, lists of names detailing groups of Jews of different lineages and different roles as they come to the land. And we've given quite a few explanations for why the text goes to the trouble of listing all of these names and all of these lineages, and just running down the list. I gave it to you on the outline. One view is that it's the style of biblical poetry. This is what the Torah thinks of as poetic. Lists of names, which just go on and on and on and on. That's poetry to them. That's one possibility. Second possibility is that it's what I called on the sheet propaganda. And it can work in either direction. Either it lists all of these people to make it look like a large group, and there was this family, and there was this family, and there was this family, or alternatively, just the opposite, to make the returnees look like a small group, because you can list them all. It may take you 70 verses, but it's a small group. Third explanation, these are the founders of the new land. We noted that these families become the bringers of various offerings, and their descendants bring offerings in their name. These are the founders, both for good and for villainy, of the new land. So you're mentioning the founders. Another explanation that we offered was that it's to emphasize the importance of the people rather than the structure of the temple. Look, we're going to list all of the people. We don't spend a lot of time on the instructions for building the temple. I didn't bring that on the sheet. I'm less convinced by that argument as time goes by. But it's one of those that we saw. We had the Talmudic answer that it's about lineage, establishing the lineage of who can marry whom. In the fallout from the exile, as there were different groups, now you need to reestablish who's who and who is allowed to marry whom. And then a last approach, which we actually didn't mention when we learned it initially, but was suggested to me during a class I gave on Yom Kippur about the Book of Ezra. Someone suggested, I thought it was interesting, maybe this is another of the parallels with the departure from Egypt, with Yetzias Mitzrayim. Because there also, we get out of Egypt and we have multiple censuses, right? Which the commentaries discuss there. Why do you need to count the Jews again? Is it to show God's love? Or whatever the explanation there is, this is a parallel. Just like when we left Egypt, we were counted, so too, when we come to the land, we're going to be counted. And I thought that was a very good idea. So I include that here as another explanation. Okay. So chapters 1 and 2, getting underway. chapters 3 and 4, first steps in a new land. So chapter 3 begins, as we build a Mizbeach, we built an altar together. The Jews did not do what Cyrus told them to do. Cyrus said, I want you to go build the altar. They did not. They went home to their cities. Then, eventually, Sukkot time, they gathered in Yerushalayim as one to build the temple. And we asked why they would have waited. And our answer was, possibly because they're afraid of hostile neighbors, they need to gather together in order to be able to defend themselves. Alternatively, we suggested that it was because they had to go home to farm and to be able to put food on the table. And then finally, we said that the timing works for them to be able to start using the altar in Tishrei and to have a formal dedication on Sukkot, because Shlomo dedicated the first temple on Sukkot. So you're going to dedicate your altar on Sukkot to parallel what happened in the first temple, and that's one of many parallels that we saw. This is the event that I mentioned earlier has a parallel passage in the 7th chapter in Nehemiah, and at that point we'll have to discuss why would it show up in the 7th chapter in Nehemiah if it's from the beginning of this return to the land. But the Jews then start to build the Beis HaMikdash. They start to build the temple. They begin to build it in Iyar, which was the month when Shlomo, King Solomon, started to build his temple. So that's another parallel that we seize. There is, as I noted, a mix of joy and disappointment, because it doesn't look like the first one. And then we hit trouble with the neighbors. The neighbors are... I'm going to stop monologuing here. The neighbors are...
The Samaritans,
right? Why do we call them Samaritans? They live in Shomron was the capital of the northern kingdom, which had been exiled by the Assyrians, and all of these other populations were brought in. We spent some time last year talking about who they are, which nations they are, but fundamentally the Assyrians invaded. They replaced the northern tribes, or most of the northern tribes anyway, with other populations. The people who are brought into the land worship idolatry. They get attacked by lions. They come back to the landlord and say, excuse me, we have a problem. The lease didn't mention anything about lions. The landlord says, okay, fine, go get some Kohanim, some priests from those Jews who were evicted, and have them teach you how to be Jewish. And so they adopt Jewish practices and say, that's the way we're going to be now, is we're going to be like the Jews. And there's a Talmudic debate which we discussed about the status of their conversion. Is a conversion under duress considered to be a valid conversion? But this group approaches the Jews who want to build the temple and say, we would like to build it with you. To which the Jews say, no. No way. That's not the terms of the agreement. And it's not what Cyrus wanted. Cyrus wanted us to build it ourselves. Why don't the Jews want the Samaritans to cooperate with them?
Because they're not Jews. At the end of the day, they'll be out of part in the temple. And be part of it if they go back.
So let them be, because you were concerned about it being used for idolatry.
Yes.
I heard there's another answer over there.
You're in the bad part of the group here.
Right. So there's certainly suspicion, and this is the view of the Malbim. Right, so there's an issue of getting too close to them. However, that's not only here. Unfortunately, it's bigger than whether you build a temple with them or not. That's a global problem, which we're going to find out they don't avoid. But you're right, that could be a consideration. Generally speaking, the commentators look at it and express concerns that are Beit HaMikdash specific, that are temple specific. Malum's concern is they want to build it as a hybrid. They want it to be for Judaism and for their gods. That's Malbim's take. Rashi's take is, no, they actually don't want us to build at all. They want to sabotage the process from the inside. So the Jews say no. And that leads to harassment on multiple levels from the Samaritans. Both diplomatic harassment, which we're going to find out more about shortly, and physical harassment, physical threats. And then the text gives us an example of diplomatic harassment. The this next part is the bulk of chapter 4 and leads into 5 and 6. And there is some debate as to whether this story is actually lifted from later in history just to illustrate what Samaritans did, or whether the story takes place at this point in the books. Leaving that debate aside, because, you know, we spent a lot of time on that last year, but the story itself is that the Samaritans go back to King Artashasta, Persian king, and they say to him, you know, these Jews are building a temple, and they're going to build walls for the city. Once they have their defenses up, you know what's going to happen next, right? You've read the history books. They're going to rebel. Right? And the Samaritans are likely correct, because that's what we do. Mm-hmm. Nonetheless, we don't like them telling that to Artashasta before, you know, the walls are done and we've actually rebelled. It's bad to telegraph that in advance. So that's the Samaritan complaint to King Artashasta, sent via royal scribes. Anyone remember their names for bonus points? Shimshi and Rechum. I wouldn't have remembered either. I looked it up. The royal scribe Shimshi and Rechum convey this. Remember, we had a discussion about whether Shimshi and Rechum know that the report is false, or not. But that's the claim that's made. The king investigates. The king agrees with their argument, and he says, "Okay, no construction." And construction stops until the second year of King Darius, and that's where the fifth chapter of Ezra picks up. So now the Jews are back in the land, but they're not building the temple. In the second year of King Darius, the prophets Haggai and Zechariah charge the Jews with continuing their building. And so the Jews start to build again. Persian governor Tatnai comes through on a supervisory visit, sees that they're building, and he says, "Excuse me, can I see your permit?" Right? Do you remember this? Can I see your papers? And they say, "Oh, papers. We had papers somewhere. They can't find them, but it's here somewhere, we know." And Tatnai says, "Okay, you can keep on building, but I'm riding away to headquarters to find out what to do." And we noted the two different views of Tatnai. You can look at Tatnai as a villain. He's an enemy. He wants to stop us from building. Or he's just a civil servant doing his job. Right? And he even said, "You can keep on building while I investigate." That doesn't really paint him as an enemy. They ride away to headquarters. Headquarters looks, can't find anything. Until they search in Madai, in Media. Remember that the royal palace moves from time to time, seasonally. So they find it in the archives in Madai. And it's a document which, like the one that began the book of Ezra, licenses the Jews to come back and build, but it's even more elaborate in its description of how the Jews should build the Beit HaMikdash. So Darius reads this document they found in the archives, and he orders Tatnai to have the construction proceed immediately, and he is very supportive personally in terms of what he promises to give for the construction and for the maintenance of the temple. And we ask the question, why is Darius so supportive? Do you remember why Darius was so supportive? So part of it may be he found the letter, and therefore that doesn't obligate him to do what he does. He promises way more support than was given in the first place. So one approach is that he's Jewish, right? Don't look at the outline I gave you, because then it'll have all the answers there. One view is that he is the son of Queen Esther and King Ahasuerus, and you can make the chronology work for Darius to be their son, and therefore it makes sense that he would support the construction of the temple. That's one possibility. Another possibility is that, like his predecessor Cyrus, he is a smart politician. He says, "I don't need to deal with revolts. They have permission from Cyrus to build. What's the big deal? Why should I anger them by withdrawing the permission they already have?" So, therefore, he says, go ahead, and he even endorses it. A third possibility is that he wants to honor his predecessor, Cyrus. We have similar things in Herodotus about the relationship across the generations between the Persian kings. He wants to honor Cyrus, so he is going to support it as well. Another take is that he's actually selfish. He believes that this will redound to his benefit, because God is going to be happy with him. And we talked about the passages in the Talmud that can be read that way, that Cyrus is doing this, expecting that he will be rewarded by God for doing so. We discussed whether that's really such a bad thing. Or fundamentally, the last answer is, this is just another example of God manipulating kings. He manipulated Cyrus, and now he's going to manipulate Darius. That's possible as well. The temple construction continues. Aspects of it mirror the first temple. For example, they build layers of three layers of stone and then a layer of wood, and that's just like what King Solomon did in the first temple. They dedicate it in the sixth year of King Darius. They have a big dedication party. They bring lots of korbanot, lots of offerings, as we discussed, and they hold a major korban Pesach. And we spent a lot of time noting that this Korban Pesach was better than the great Korban Pesach of King Chizkiyahu in the first temple. He did a great Korban Pesach, but there, people didn't purify themselves, they didn't listen to him, they thought the whole thing was a joke, he ended up doing it in the wrong month. Here, everybody's on time, and it's done on the right day, and everybody is enthusiastic about it, and it's wonderful. So that's the end of chapter 6. It didn't take us, you know, that long to do all this. That brings us to chapter 7 and 8, and Ezra arrives. So at this point, the Persian king is named Artaxasta, which again may be a generic name for Persian kings, or maybe a personal name of this king. But Ezra is known to King Artaxasta as a righteous teacher of Torah in Babylon. In terms of Ezra's identity, we know that his father or grandfather, it's unclear which it is, named Sariah, was a Kohen Gadol, was a high priest. We know that he is a scholar of Torah. The Talmud adds that he stayed in exile in Babylon. He didn't come back initially because he wanted to learn from Baruch ben Neria, who was also a sofer, a scholar and scribe. Baruch ben Neria was the scribe of Yirmiyahu Hanavi, of Jeremiah. So that this would make him a bridge for going back to the first temple. Jeremiah from the first temple, his student Baruch ben Neria, and then Ezra at the start of the second, makes for a good chain of tradition. But he has been active. The Talmud tells us that he was the one who sorted out all the lineages, so that we could have this nice name list. Ezra's public roles, well, he's introduced in chapter 7 with 15 generations of his lineage, which you have to think is meant to underscore his importance, and not that we just needed to fill up space. He is credited Talmudically with establishing the alphabet that we think of as the Hebrew alphabet, in those days called Ketav Ashurit, the Assyrian alphabet. He establishes the proper text of the Torah. He establishes public Torah study. He frames Jewish law with various enactments that are meant to protect and build it. Yes?
So we say that the alphabet existed from the beginning of time and Garfield, so how did he establish the alphabet?
Right.
Did he establish the alphabet? Did he invent cursive?
Right. So the Talmud has a nice big debate on this point. I think we discussed it marginally when we talked about Ezra's introduction. We didn't do it at great length. But you have multiple views. You have one view that says that the modern Hebrew alphabet was used initially and then was taken away and he restored it. You have another view that suggests it was only used for sacred things initially, but Ezra now makes it the alphabet we're going to use going forward. You have a variety of opinions about the nature of this alphabet. Keep in mind, alphabet and language are two different things. Meaning, the idea that the original language is Hebrew, right, was supported in the Torah portion from last Shabbat, where Adam names all the animals, and we talk about those names being Hebrew names and so forth, and even just Ish and Isha are meant to convey the idea that they're speaking Hebrew. However, the font that you use, the pictures you use to describe each letter is what we're talking about here when we talk about alphabets. So that's an important distinction to make.
They just look different, but it still was alphabet.
Correct. The same characters, same number of characters, same things being expressed.
Wasn't there a time where they actually they were using the modern one, but for holy stuff, they still use the old?
So there are scrolls. There are scrolls among the Dead Sea Scrolls in which the four-letter name of God is written using the old alphabet, and everything else is written with the with Ketav Ashurit. And there are different theories as to why that was done that way. So the Samaritans, I think, actually continued to do it that way. So Artaxasta literally gives Ezra the keys to the kingdom. He gives them outsized financial support, including the right to take money for the temple from the tax collection, the government tax collection in the area. Remember we said that if you take literally the maximum amounts that are given to Ezra, like the money amount is one third of what we estimate was collected in taxes every year in the entire region. He isn't carte blanche, basically. He says to Ezra, your mission is going to be to teach the law of God in this area and to impose it as law recognized by the Persian government. And if people don't know it, then you will teach it to them. Not only that, you can carry out any punishment up to and including capital punishment for people who violate that law. Oh, and by the way, you and anybody who work in the temple are exempt from taxation. That's what Artaxerxes gives to Ezra. Diana.
So what did the Persians get out of this?
So what do the Persians get out of this? And the answer is naming rights. Meaning that the way I look at this, and this was a Don Mikra suggestion, I think it's dead on, is that this is really being looked at as a Persian government building at this stage, which is consistent with the idea that all the people who work there are exempt from taxes, the idea that you can use tax money in order to support it, the idea that the laws of this building are recognized as Persian law. So what it means is they're now insulated against rebellion. Right? You want your temple functioning. It's functioning very well as Persia's Beis HaMikdash. So you never want to risk that. So that's essentially what they get is naming rights. It's worth remembering that at this period of time, historically, depending on a little bit on which chronology you use, but at roughly this time, 520 to 510 before the Common Era, the Persians are dealing with all sorts of mini revolts in this area. So if they can keep us stable, they're happy. I think it's an important point. So at this point, Ezra makes his aliyah. We are told in the text that he has about 1,800 men with him. We extrapolate from there, the Dat Mikra does, Professor Salo Baron does, to mean that there were probably about 9,000 people. I don't know why they assume that there are five people in a family at that point, but it sounds like a nice number. Okay, so about 9,000 people. Yeah. It is a round number. So the Jews gather under Ezra on the first of Nisan, great symbolism for the departure from Egypt. Ezra tries to rally Levium. He doesn't have many. He has to go digging to find Levium. And the Talmud notes that he punishes Levi by taking away their claim to Maaser Rishon, to one of the key tithes, and he gives it either to the Kohanim, the priests, or to the Aniyim, to the needy. Ezra holds a great big public prayer before they leave. Not just because he likes big public prayer, although he does, but he does it because he doesn't want to ask the king for protective escort. He could have gotten it, he's given everything else, but he doesn't want to, because he has told the king the wonders of God, and that God takes care of those who support him, and that God harms those who want to harm his followers. So he says, what am I going to do now? I'm going to knock on his door and say, can you give me a police escort? I'll look silly. I'll look silly, but he's not going to believe everything I've been telling him. So therefore, we're going to hold a big public prayer and ask God to help us. And that's what he does, and that's what they do, and they set out on a months-long journey on the strength of their prayer. They arrive in the month of Av. So if you think about the chronology of months, right, that means that they travel, they started out on the 12th of Nisan in the end. So about half of the month of Nisan, Iyar Sivan Tammuz, 3 months, so it's 3.5 months. And they arrive in the month of Av, the first day of Av, as I recall, which is important because that's the yahrzeit of whom? Nope. Aaron HaKohen's yahrzeit. The only yahrzeit that is mentioned explicitly in Chumash is Aaron on the first day of the month of Av. And there's obvious symbolism in this. First of all, symbolism because Ezra is the Kohen, not the Kohen Gadol, interestingly, but he is the Kohen who will lead them in the beginning of the Second Temple, parallel to Aaron, who was the Kohen who led us when we left Egypt. Right, we even noted that very interesting comment of the Chidah that Ezra is the Gilgul of Aaron. He's the reincarnation of Aaron, if you like. But the other symbolism is that Av is known as a month of mourning and grief, and now he's converting it to a month of joy. They deliver gifts to the temple, they bring a new round of offerings, including memorably a chatat, a sin offering to atone for the idolatry worshipped in the first temple. So at this point, everybody's happy, right? We've come back, we built an altar, we built a Beit HaMikdash, a temple. We dedicated it. We kept out those nasty Samaritans, and we managed to defeat their harassment. And Ezra is back, and he has the power to teach Torah and the power to use Torah law in order to govern, and everything is wonderful. If you just ended with chapter 8, at that point you'd say, the Jews are in a good place. And then you'd hit chapter 9 and say, oops. So that is, I think we noted this in the beginning of our studies last year. Where does our edition of Tanakh end?
With Chronicles.
Right, with Divrei HaYamim. Yeah. Divrei HaYamim ends at the beginning of the book of Ezra. If our edition of Tanakh were organized chronologically, it would end with Ezra and Nehemiah. So why is it that Ezra and Nehemiah are moved back and Divrei HaYamim is put at the end? So you could say that it's because Divrei HaYamim is Book of Chronicles and you should end with Chronicles even if they don't take you up to the last minute. But another answer which is suggested is that it's because Divrei HaYamim ends with a happy ending. Chronicles ends with Cyrus saying, anybody who wants to go back to Israel, ascend, go up. That's a great happy note, and it's a much better ending than the Jews married in among the Canaanites and got into trouble, and, you know, etc. Which is where it actually goes. So therefore, we end with Divrei HaYamim, we put that at the ending, which is what we do all the time in Tanakh. When a book has an unhappy ending, right, and it's read for a haftorah in shul, what do? We go back to a preceding verse and we repeat that one to give it a nice happy ending. That's what we do. So that's what happened in Tanakh. So here we get to the unhappy part, which is Ezra chapters 9 and 10. And finally, we're at almost the 1 hour mark. We're gonna get to the end of our review. We noted that the book of Malachi, which is dated the second generation of the Second Temple, in other words, the time of Ezra. The book of Malachi has, as part of it, the theme of intermarriage, and the Jews having married into the nations around them. And the criticism of Malachi is that when you choose to take somebody from another nation, you are betraying your people. You have all of these people you could have married, and you're rejecting them, and instead looking outside of the family. That's the way that he presents it, and it's very interesting because it's not what you think of as the normal argument. The normal objection is you're betraying God, but Malachi presents it as a betrayal of your Jewish spouses. Remember that this is the age of polygamy, so they have more than one. There is a view, which we talked about, that suggests that intermarriage with the Canaanites is biblically prohibited, but intermarriage with the other tribes, and there are no Canaanites by this time, so basically intermarriage with anybody around them, was not biblically prohibited. Only if you're going to marry somebody who's going to lead you into idolatry do you have a problem. And according to that view, the prohibition against general intermarriage is rabbinic, and it's in fact created by Ezra. However, as we noted, it's very, very hard to read the text that way. Because in the text, when people find out that Jews have been marrying Canaanites, they immediately go charging off to Ezra to say, can you imagine? And Ezra sits on the ground grieving, fasting, tearing his hair out. If it was permitted, why would he be tearing his hair out? Why did anybody come to him? They're doing what they're allowed to do. So it's a hard view to sustain the idea that it was Ezra who prohibited it. This event, in which it is discovered that Jews are in fact marrying among the Canaanites, seems to be 4 months after Ezra arrives. Rashi believes this is actually about intermarriage that occurred in Babylon. But the text itself and various commentators, including Medrash, say that no, this is marriage in Israel. Like, think about what that means. The people Ezra handpicked to come with him are included among those who have now married in Canaan. All the families that Ezra spent so much time trying to figure out, these are Kohanim, these are Levim, these are Mamzerim, these are Halalim, these are Avi Shlomo, these are whatever, have now decided, yeah, thank you for all your work on our records, and now we're going to go marry Chiti or whoever else, you know, whoever's around. Sorry?
Mary Rosemary?
Yes. The text here, interestingly, sounds like it's not just the rank and file who are doing this, but the leaders are doing it. It actually says the leaders are engaged in this. No pun intended. So the question is, why is the text telling us this? What is the point? So one view is that it's just like the time of the Shoftim, of the judges, in which Shimshon comes to mind. Everybody's got problems. It's very hard to find anybody who is pure. That's one possibility. Second possibility would be that they thought that the prohibition is only the Canaanite tribes. They thought it was fine. But Rabbi Yosef Kahaneman had this fascinating approach in which he said that the leaders of the time thought, we have a very weak and small Jewish population. We need to build it up. So the way we will build it up is if we will marry from those who are around us. Keep in mind that he wrote this Rav Kahaneman wrote this as a polemic against, in the whole who was a Jew matrilineal descent discussion in the 1950s. So, I mean, he's clearly connecting the two and doing so for a reason. But in response to this news, Ezra acts out mourning. He fasts, he prays to God. He does not do something else, though. We've spent time on the fact that Ezra has the right to do whatever he wants. Right? Ezra could have said, off with their heads. He doesn't do anything. Not a thing. He doesn't say, now we're going to do this. He doesn't impose fines. He doesn't make rules. He just grieves. He says, this is terrible. And that's part of Ezra's identity, which we've seen already and we will continue to see, is that Ezra is not somebody who's going to impose his will on others. He wants to inspire. That's what he's looking to do. But he wants other people to actually move and take the actions. Maybe because philosophically he doesn't believe it's going to go anywhere if it just comes from him. That could be the logic. So the nation comes to Ezra, led by a man named Shechaniah ben Yechiel, who you will recall, the Dat Mikra, was it the Dat Mikra? Somebody, compared to Pinchas. And this Shechaniah ben Yechiel says, we have sinned, and now we need to separate from the non-Jewish wives. And he specifies non-Jewish wives as opposed to non-Jewish spouses. And that was the last bit that we did. The first question you have to ask is, why wasn't conversion an option? Why are you talking about separating them from their spouses? Let them convert. So the secular view is that there was no such thing as organized conversion at this point in history. It didn't exist. Either you're born Jewish or you're not born Jewish. The other view, the traditional approach, says conversion wasn't appropriate here. As Ibn Ezra writes, this isn't a righteous population that's looking to become Jewish and practice Judaism. You married Samaritans. What makes you think that you can convert them and they're going to be loyal Jews? And therefore, he didn't do it. Rav Meidan, writing on this, Rav Yaakov Meidan, says that the nation is so weak at this stage that even if one of the people they had married from the Canaanim was someone who was going to be sincere, Ezra probably would have dropped them anyway, just because the nation is in such trouble, it needs strengthening and support. It doesn't. You can't afford to weaken it. So that was the. Those are the different views about why conversion is not proposed. Clearly, the religious view, from my perspective, is that conversion has existed since Sinai, right? Har Sinai, giving of the Torah, is the first conversion. We went to mikvah, we had a karban, we said nasa v'nishma, we will do, we will hear. The males already had a bris from the karban Pesach, and that's what you. That's the template for conversion. But I bring you all the different approaches. And that's what we're up to now, which I guess we'll start with next time, which is the issue of matrilineal descent. I do intend to move faster than last year because we got through so much of the groundwork in Ezra it really does set the table for what you're going to see in Nehemiah. So, God willing, next week we will back here. We will be back here in specifically Ezra chapter 9, and moving ahead into chapter 10. Thank you very much.
Thank you.